the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. What is the new name you throw around, the new epithet, the new code word you throw around about Christian conservatives? You call us theocrats. A lot of you being called theocrats, you don't even know that that threat is out there. What in the world is this all about? We're going to have a very special guest, Russ Duthat, writing in First Things magazine, very influential piece. On the false alarm over theocracy. And we're going to be talking about what is really behind a lot of these books coming out, a lot of the stuff you're going to see in the media, and a lot of the name-calling going on out there as we are in this rather pitched cultural controversy over any number of issues. The lines are dividing up. It's not only red state, blue state. There are other lines as well. But one of the chief things now going on is that Christian conservatives are being accused of wanting to establish a theocracy. We're going to talk about just what that means and why it's not true. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Of course, over the weekend, the biggest news in so many ways domestically was the crash. Comair Flight 5191, Delta affiliate in Lexington, Kentucky, crashed just short of a mile past Bluegrass Field. And what we now know makes this crash all the more scary. Because what we know is that by every appearance, the pilot took off on a runway that was too short. Instead of taking off on runway 22, by compass heading, it took off on runway 26. Instead of it being 7,003 feet long, it was less than half that long. In fact, it was about 1,500 feet short of what is necessary for one of these Canadian regional jets to take off safely, much less one of these jets, twin engine, filled with 50 persons, 49 dead. This is truly scary stuff. 50 persons on that plane, 49 passengers and 3 crew. Now, we have been through what has been described as one of the safest periods in American aviation history. The last major crash was shortly after 9/11 with a crash of an American Airlines jumbo jet that killed 260 persons in the New York area along with 5 persons on the ground. But flying is always an unusual and artificial event for human beings. It is made possible by incredible advances in technology and by the development of jet engines and all the rest, and we now take it as almost routine. But I'll tell you, my first response to this crash is, of course, a sense of tragedy and loss, sympathy for all the families involved, and the stories, of course, come to us with such emotional energy. A young couple who had their honeymoon the night before, they were married the night before, headed for their honeymoon, and they died. I just saw on the victims list, which is still incomplete, a 16-year-old girl. And then you had plenty of people just headed off to do business, going to horse shows, going to a cruise in Alaska, and all the rest. What really strikes me in the second place here is that these people did not know what was about to happen. In other words, the weather wasn't really problematic, so they weren't worried about that. There was little reason to believe that there would be any terrorist strike on a commuter jet taking off from Lexington, Kentucky. And have you ever really pondered just how much trust is involved in flight? In other words, the passengers did not make the decision to take off on the shorter runway. It wasn't put up for a Democratic vote. This wasn't something they decided. Most of them, if not all of them, were almost surely completely unaware even of what was happening until that plane crashed. We operate in every day of our lives, if not so graphically as on an airliner, then in many other ways, perhaps more subtle and unseen, we operate on the basis of trust. When we come to a red light, we trust that the person coming the other way will stop when the light is red. While we're going down the expressway, we trust that people will stay on the right lane and not come over into the wrong lane. We trust persons, well, when we hand off our children to the child care at church, or when we allow them to cross the street, when the little white sign comes on blinking that it's safe to walk, we trust that the medicine that's in the vial is the right medicine for us. We trust that people mean good for us, not ill. We have to operate on the basis of enormous trust. In fact, you could even call it faith in everyday life. But this is a reminder to us that when it comes not just to everyday life, but the life that is to come, it is a matter of faith. Our faith in the goodness, in the perfection, in the trustworthiness, in the accomplished work of the Lord Jesus Christ. And in him we can place our total trust. In no one else. That is one thing that comes as a reminder from this accident. We can place our full faith in no one else. I am absolutely certain that the pilot who made this decision, as it now appears, did so intending no harm to himself or to his passengers. But we are finite and frail human beings. What we do is tainted with failure. What we make is prone to fail. And that is why all creation, as Paul tells us in Romans chapter 8, is yearning, groaning for the completion and the perfection of the sons of men, that which can be done only by God. Our sympathy and condolences to all the families and all those involved in the crash of Comair Flight 5191. There are so many other issues in the news. In the New York Times front page on Saturday, headline, Clergywomen Find Hard Path to Bigger Pulpit. Now, just in the last few days in my blog at conventionalthinking.net, I published an article that really nails the fact that even in liberal denominations that say that they support women in the pastorate, they really don't. And looking in particular at more moderate and liberal Baptist denominations that say they believe in women in the pastorate, very few actually do. And what I'm arguing is that that itself is something of a testimony to the fact that that men are called to preach rather than women is basically held reflexively, if not vocally, by persons in the pews of so many churches. And now this news article from the front page of the New York Times tells us that even in the most liberal denominations, women are having a very hard time getting called to the biggest pulpits, the most influential churches, the ones with the largest membership, etc. Now, the article is really raising the question as to why that is so, looking at some particular women and their ministries. But I think the reason is that there is opposition to women serving in the pulpit, even in these most liberal denominations. When it comes to the actual people who sit in the pews, there is still resistance. Now, one of the questions that comes from this, and let me just remind you that I just to be honest, I am a complementarian. That is to say, I interpret the Bible in terms of what I believe its clear teachings to very clearly insist that men and men alone are to be pastors. Not all men, only those that are specially called and equipped by God to be pastors. There are different roles for men and women in the home and in the church. That's a revolutionary and rather stunning statement for some people today, but I believe it's clearly revealed in the Scripture. And the point of raising this is to say that it now looks like the people in the pews get it, even when some in the bureaucracy and elsewhere do not. Speaking of getting it, these persistent gender differences vex those who want to continue to argue that there's no basic difference between men and women. And now we have a study by Thomas Dee, an associate professor of economics at Swarthmore College, visiting scholar at Stanford University, who is reporting in the journal Education Next that boys learn more from men and girls learn more from women in the classroom. Thomas Dee has conducted a rather significant research project that is showing this. He says, and I quote, "We should be thinking more carefully about why this is true." Already there are critics who are coming out to complain about this, but Mr. Dee warns that one of the reasons that boys may be falling behind in the educational system is because the census of male teachers is now at its lowest level in 40 years. By proportion, roughly 80% of teachers in U.S. public schools are women. Now, just consider that for a moment. If it's true, as this research tends to indicate, and I think as most of us anecdotally know, that boys learn better from men and girls learn better from women, if 80% of the teachers in the public schools are women, and this is especially so at the younger grades, then we can understand why we may have institutionalized a structural problem here. The question of gender is really a big issue for all of us in every aspect of life. Thomas Dee found that having a female teacher instead of a male teacher raised the achievement of girls and lowered that of boys in science, social studies, and English. With female teachers, boys are more likely to be seen as disruptive. Girls are less likely to be considered inattentive or disorderly. But in a class taught by a man, girls were more likely to say the subject was not useful for them. They were less likely to look forward to the class or ask questions. Folks, I think there's a lesson there. And I think we know it. Meanwhile, from Bremerton, Washington, there's the report that a man who climbed up in a fig tree and remained there for several hours talking to himself was accidentally shot in the leg by a deputy police officer who was reaching instead for his taser gun. The man who witnessed this, David Bakersley, who saw the man get shot by accident, he said his reaction was to say, "Ow, that hurt, I'm coming down, I'm coming down." Well, I guess so. They shot him. Folks, there are issues of great importance and issues of, well, great interest in the newspaper and in the media. We separate the wheat from the chaff. We try our best to think like Christians. We'll be back to talk about whether or not we're in danger of a theocracy. Coast to Coast, this is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back. The word theocrat is now being thrown around as an epithet, code word. It's a form of name-calling, and conservative Christians are being called theocrats because of influence in public policy, or even an aspiration to have some influence in public policy. But are we in danger of establishing a theocracy? Are we in danger of having an encroaching, government, wedding of church and state to the extent that we establish some kind of republic or some kind of system of government whereby there's an absolute fusion of some religion and law, much like you would have in Iran with what we know as a Shiite theocracy. Now, what's going on here is, I think, a demonstration of paranoia, and that is the very first line in an excellent essay by Russ Douthat in First Things, leading intellectual journal in America. He says, this is a paranoid moment in American politics. It reminds me of a bulletin board poster that was up when I was in high school in a psychology class. They said this. They said, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not all out to get you. Well, there are several critics out here of conservative Christians who aim to make a point, and that point is to scare Americans about the danger of conservative Christianity and the cultural and political ambitions of conservative Christians. Mr. Douthat's with us today on the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, I really did appreciate your essay in First Things. And, the approach you've taken is exactly what I think is right. I mean, we should be open to legitimate criticism. And any movement, including conservative Christianity, has issues it needs to address. And we need to hear the opposition. But it's getting increasingly hard to hear this as anything other than paranoia.
I absolutely agree. One of the points I made in the essay was that it's not a terribly new thing, in a way, for people to throw around the term theocracy, and you heard it a lot in the 1980s when the religious right was first making waves on the political scene. But it's definitely reached a fever pitch, I think, in the last couple of years, starting with the 2004 election, when you had this idea that, you know, it was values voters that had pushed George W. Bush over the top, and suddenly everyone in the media discovered this idea that, oh, there are these, you know, scary conservative Christians out there who are all voting Republican. And I think, in a way, that was an expression of the media's bafflement over Bush's victory, and they were sort of casting around for explanations, and the values voter explanation happened to be the one readiest to hand. But it's led to just a wave of, I use the example of these four books, but you see it in newspaper columns and magazine articles. It's almost standard now to say, well, there's a certain 20% to 30% of America that wants to establish a theocracy, and it's just ridiculous.
Well, let's define our terms here. What is a theocracy? How would you define it?
Well, a theocracy, there are several different kinds, but basically it involves the establishment of religion, but also government by religious authorities. So it goes beyond just having an official state church. You also have to have clerics either writing the laws or setting governmental policy in some way, as you have in Iran now, as you had in Afghanistan under the Taliban, as you arguably had, say, in Cromwell's England or Puritan New England. And obviously nothing like that is close to happening in the United States today. I think if all the leaders of the religious right were suddenly put in a room and allowed to set public policy, they wouldn't be able to agree on what policies to set.
Well, and as a matter of fact, I can almost guarantee you that they don't want to set policies having to do with any range of things that government has to do with. As a matter of fact, probably 80% of what government has to do with. And it's interesting, I was just ransacking my own historical imagination, and Cromwell's Commonwealth was about the only thing I could come up with as a classic theocracy. Even Puritan New England was more of an accidental theocracy, village by village and town by town. But, you know, I agree with you. There's simply no threat. And I have to answer this all the time. There are movements within conservative Christianity that would lean this way. I think particularly of the Dominion theology, Reconstructionism, but that was a movement that really peaked in the 1980s. So in one sense, these books are coming kind of two decades late.
Well, and what you see, I think, in a lot of these books is people coming into the world of Christianity, and particularly evangelical Christianity, coming in ignorance and coming in with certain suppositions, presuppositions, such as, well, there must be some kind of something dangerous here, something theocratic, and then they run into the Reconstructionist or the Dominionist. They encounter it and they say, oh, aha, this is the secret. I've found it. Everybody's out to, you know, use R.J. Rushdoony's theories and make them the law of the land.
I don't know if you've seen Peter Steinfeld's article in the American Prospect, but here you have a writer writing in a journal of the American intellectual left arguing, and he's reviewing some of the same books, by the way, and he's arguing, look, the problems we have with this administration aren't caused by Christian conservatives, but by others. You know, he's saying those on the secular left are really missing the point in trying to argue that conservative Christians want a theocracy.
I haven't actually seen that essay, but I think it's an excellent point. And one of the strangest things in this whole anti-theocratic hysteria is precisely that you have people on the left attacking figures like, for instance, Sam Brownback or Rick Santorum or whoever, who are the people on the right who in theory they should have a lot in common with. They're concerned about poverty, you know, Sam Brownback is interested in prison reform and so on. And the forces in the Bush administration that I think people on the left should be more concerned about tend to be, you know, the forces of big business and moneyed interests and so on. And, you know, depending on what you think about the Iraq War, perhaps some sort of overconfident or reckless foreign policymakers. But instead, everybody's singling out the religious right. It's an easy scapegoat. And a lot of it just has to do with the secularization, I think, of the media and sort of the intellectuals in our country. And you have people who are unfamiliar with religion. And if you're unfamiliar with religion, you're more likely to be frightened by it.
Well, the fright here, Mr. Douthat, seems to be that conservative Christians are willing to use explicitly Christian argumentation when it comes to public policy. And, you know, whether it's people in the academy like John Rawls and Robert Audi or whomever, the secular left has basically decided that anyone who shows up with an expressly religious argument about restraining human behavior has to be a theocrat.
Yes, I that's right. And that's, one, a complete misreading of American history. I think that if you went through American history and started eliminating all the famous figures who use explicitly religious argumentation, you're getting rid of Lincoln, you're getting rid of William Jennings Bryan, you're getting rid of Martin Luther King. It's completely...
You're getting rid of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Absolutely.
Who used more biblical...
Practically every... Yeah. I mean, America's always had a tension between, you know, between secularism and religion. We've always had, you know, a stronger separation of church and state than some European countries and so on. Clearly, there are secular forces in American political history, but the influence of religion in American political life from the beginning until the present day is enormous, and to try and read that out as somehow undemocratic is... Well, it's outrageous.
Well, there are about a dozen new books in this genre, the same line of argument coming out. I looked at Publishers Weekly last night, and I could flag at least 10 to 12 books that
are
going to come out.
There's no end to them. It's amazing.
Yeah, Jimmy Carter, former president, is coming out with a new one. You have Richard Dawkins, the Oxford evolutionary theorist, coming out with one. You don't see any end to this anytime soon, right?
Well, I think the end of it will come when these books don't sell well. But I think it'll take a little while for the market to react to the glut. But no, as long as there's a cultural division, which is the division that produces our culture war, you'll keep having these kind of misunderstandings and fear-mongering.
Russ Douthat, that's the article of this review essay published at First Things. It's available at their website at firstthings.org. He is also associate editor at Atlantic Monthly. Mr. Douthat, thank you for joining us on the Albert Miller Program.
Thank you so much for having me.
First Things, by the way, is a journal that always provokes interest, and we've talked about several of their articles on this program. We'll be back to talk about whether or not we're in danger of a theocracy. The phone number is 877-893-8255.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, maybe for Christians, the easiest political situation to figure out is when you have no influence on the government and are being persecuted. We can figure that out. We know what Christians are supposed to do under that circumstance. We've got the New Testament. We have the experience of the early Christians. We know that in such a situation, we have to refuse to bow the knee to Caesar. And we have to give witness to Christ, even if that means violating the law and going up against the regime. Where Christians have a much more difficult task is when we have influence. When, for instance, we're living in a participatory democracy, a constitutional republic, where we have a voice, we have a vote, we have the opportunity to make our voice known. You know, just how should Christians then operate? To what extent should we seek to have Christian principles instilled in law? To what extent should we use expressly Christian arguments when dealing with things that that get to be right in the neighborhood of where Christian conviction has to be, you know, at odds with the secular thinking on an issue like euthanasia, on an issue like marriage, on issues related to sexuality? These are raging issues. And what we have right now in our political context is you have a secular left that is arguing that every time Christians show up and say, my thinking is Christian, that's what motivates me, that this is an effort to install or inaugurate a theocracy. I think Russ Douthat's exactly right. That's not only an exaggeration, it's paranoia. But buckle your seatbelts, because there's a lot of this that's coming, especially with the election cycle and all the rest. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Scott calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Scott.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Glad to hear from you.
I just wanted to say that, you know, I know more than a few non-Christians that believe that, you know, there's some sort of theocracy forming, and what they don't understand is that it would hurt us as much as it would hurt them. I mean, how many different denominations of Christianity? My fiance is Catholic. You know, I'm Protestant. You know, which form of theocracy are they saying we're forming?
Well, you know, do your secular friends really, I mean, genuinely, Scott, think that they see a theocracy on the horizon?
They consider Bush unfit to lead because they consider him saying that he hears from God as delusional. So they think that's basically their stance.
But I mean, that's not even close to any kind of argument about a theocracy. That sounds like they're doing a psychoanalysis of the president. You know, I think they're just throwing the word around. And I think that's what Russ Douthat makes very clear in his review essay. And I think just looking at these books, the four books he reviewed, and then lots of them coming along. You have books getting a lot of attention. Randall Balmer's book on evangelicals and theology. Michelle Goldberg. And a raft of these books that are coming out. Jimmy Carter's book, Our Endangered Values. And now I'm told there was an article out last night saying he's got even a new one coming out. James Rudin, Rabbi Rudin's book, The Baptizing of America, The Religious Rights Plans for the Rest of Us, etc., etc. Now, from inside evangelical Christianity, I can just tell you this looks like nonsense. And also with an historical perspective, and this was Mr. Douthat's point, from an historical perspective, this looks like absolute nonsense. For instance, to reject same-sex marriage is to inaugurate a theocracy. Does that mean that America was a theocracy until now, or is one even now? To render abortion no longer legal, to push back on the culture of death, does that mean that we have inaugurated a theocracy? Does that mean that before January of 1973, America was a theocracy? And that's the kind of question that these folks evidently don't answer. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let me say again, there is a legitimate debate to be had among Christians, and especially among conservative evangelical Christians, as to just to what extent we should seek to have the civil law mirror what we believe to be Christian principles. But there is, even reflexively, among Christians, a sense that when it comes to where the law is deciding what is and is not, for instance, life deserving of human dignity, and what is and is not marriage and so many other things, it's impossible, to make an argument without coming forth and saying this is based in my Christian conviction. The same way that the civil rights movement rode on the same kind of argument. You know, in the end of the day, why is murder wrong? From a secular worldview, you have to say it's just, well, from an evolutionary social development, inconvenient. There's got to be more to it than that. The phone number, 877-893-8255. Coast to coast, this is the Albert Miller Program. Let's go to David calling from Boone, Iowa, listening on KFFF Radio. Go ahead, David.
Oh, Al, thanks for taking my call.
Go right ahead.
I believe that Christ said all power and authority in heaven and earth has been given to me, so I think my understanding is that the world is a theocracy, the whole world, and most of the governments, well, all of the governments to some degree, are still in rebellion to God, but Christ will be at the right hand of the Father until he places all his enemies, makes a footstool out of all of his enemies. And so I think we would be wise to conform to his commandments if we don't want his rod chastening us.
Okay, play that out just a bit for me, David, so I understand what you mean. When you say the world is a theocracy, you know, I think anyone who reads the Bible as a believer has to see that Christ is Lord over all, but that is not realized in individual governments, and to the best of my knowledge, it has been realized in no government. I mean, are you suggesting that it's possible that we could have a truly Christian government?
Well, I'm saying that to people who have eyes to see, like Elijah, it is realized. God is in control of all things. He really is not, you know, his angelic hosts are all about us, and it's not just an imaginary thing. It's an imaginary thing for us to think that we're as powerful and controlling. It's an imaginary thing to think that these bureaucrats in Washington are who we should go for help, when they're largely the problem, because they're some of the most rebellious people against God.
Yeah, well, you know, there's an argument to be made there, but we also have to recognize that the law is not an illusion, and at least in our political process, as we're involved with it now, we're dealing with decisions that will make a difference in the way the law is constituted and the way that people live. Appreciate your call, David. Let's go to Stephen calling from Berea, Kentucky, listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, Stephen.
Thank you, Al. I just wanted to make the statement, you know, in my walk as a believer, I am being discipled and trying to make disciples. And I think that my brothers and sisters agree that although we engage the government in order to stand up for rights of those who have no voice, like unborn children, we do not believe that by taking control of a government we can change the hearts of people.
Yeah, so you're making the very clear point that you cannot redeem persons through government.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that is an essential point to be made, and there those who suffer under the illusion that government can solve the problem of human sin miss the whole point of what the New Testament tells us government is charged with in terms of authority. Romans 13 does not give the government a missiological or an evangelistic mandate. It instead says that government has the very minimal but important responsibility to maintain order and to punish the evildoer. Now, Stephen, you would acknowledge that, and you did, when you talked about protecting the unborn, you would acknowledge that Christians have some very important responsibilities in a constitutional republic like this. And, you know, I guess, well, let me just ask you this. You do, I would assume, believe that the law is still important insofar as the law is used to convict persons of a crime, if not in their hearts, to convict them of sin.
Absolutely. Romans 13.
Good point. Appreciate you listening in Berea. Thanks for your call. Let's go to Eric, listening on WFIA in Jeffersonville, Indiana. Go ahead, Eric.
Hey, Dr. Mueller. I think we give people the perception that we're theocrats, or many of us are theocrats, because we our arguments are too simplistic. If you were to ask most Christians why we should legislate against X, they would simply say, well, X is wrong. And if you extend that out far enough, that really means we'd legislate against anything that's wrong. And that's really not what we have in mind, but because we don't enunciate that very clearly, I think we give people the perception that we are willing to use the law to legislate against any and all sin.
Yeah, well, and Eric, that's a very interesting point. For instance, someone says, the basis of the law should be the Ten Commandments. Well, let's remember the first of those Ten Commandments, that is the first table of the law, which very clearly establishes the worship of the one true and living God. And not only that, but the worship that he mandates, worship with no images, et cetera. I think there are Christians who would jump to that kind of argument without thinking about whether that's actually the kind of goal one should have. Because one could legislate that in terms, and this gets back to the call that came from Stephen. I got to get my name straight here. That comes back and you say, look, you can mandate that persons worship the one true and living God, but that is not their heart. You can't mandate that to their heart. I think that's very, very important. Eric, appreciate your call. And, when evangelicals show up, conservative Christians show up with positions and no argument, we make ourselves look immature. And I guess not only unthoughtful, but perhaps you're right. Perhaps that makes us look all the more dangerous because we just throw around whatever argument, appears to be convenient. It's wrong. What's really interesting is that out there in the secular world, the debate right now, as it's being argued in the law schools and elsewhere, is whether or not, though, you can show up with Christian arguments, not just Christian positions, but Christian arguments. I spoke to this in a lecture on Capitol Hill just about 2 years ago. Because you have serious arguments being made that when you show up and you say that my worldview is shaped by, for instance, the starting point of the existence and sovereignty of an infinite God, and the speaking God who reveals his word, and thus I root my understanding of human dignity and human honor and human life and the notions of the good and the beautiful and the true in the existence of this self-revealing God, then they say, well, that's just out of bounds. My argument is it can't be out of bounds. That is at least the worldview the conviction held by, if not a majority, because I'm not going to play pollster here, at least a large segment of the population whose animating principles are essentially Christian. You see, that's what the secular world maybe really fears. And I would suggest in so doing, they're fearing the wrong thing. They fear persons whose basic animating principles are divinely revealed. And yet for Christians, there's no other choice. We can't, as Christians, find our basic worldview, orientation, truth claim, anywhere but in the Word of God. But we have to show up making arguments, intelligent, carefully crafted arguments, not just throwing around the fact that this is what we believe. We have started a conversation about something very, very important, and especially as we go through this next several weeks, this is going to come up again and again. We'll be reviewing the issue with you. Thanks for your calls. Get ready to call again on this topic. We'll continue the conversation, and I'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Miller Program. Well, it's heating up all over America. Primaries, we're headed into the big vote, the off-year elections that will come in November. And, of course, the media is already focused on this, and they have already skipped all the way to the 2008 presidential race. And the big questions are, who's winning, who's losing in the presidential stakes? Red state, blue state, which side's winning, which party's going to have control of Congress and all the rest? From a Christian perspective, these questions are important, but they're not ultimate. We have to always keep that in mind. Politics doesn't deal with the ultimate. It deals with the penultimate. It deals with issues of genuine importance, and there is an incredible stewardship given to government, but it doesn't deal with that which is most important, and that is with the reign of God and with the salvation of souls. Government does not have that charge. And as a matter of fact, government can take your life, can conscript you into military service, can confiscate your property, but it can't touch your soul. For Christians, one of the perennial issues is how we respond to government. I began this program by saying that's easier to figure out when you're being persecuted by a government that is an autocracy, whether it's some kind of totalitarian dictatorship or whether it's the imperial government of Rome, and you have no choice, you have no influence. But we're living in a representative democracy. We're living in a constitutional republic where we, even as Christians, have a responsibility, we have a vote, and we have a voice. Knowing how to use that vote and that voice most faithfully is a constant Christian challenge. And the big question, of course, is to what extent it is even possible to inculcate Christian principles in law and in government. To what extent should we even seek to do this? There are some who are saying, look, we should just pull back and no longer even seek to have Christian influence on issues like marriage and sexuality and all the rest, because this is a secular government. And there are people who are saying, look, we're just getting a black eye for talking about these issues and for refusing to go along. There are people on the other side who are pushing for what amounts to a simple adoption of any number of what are known or characterized as Christian positions on issues to be inculcated into law. Between that is, I think, the kind of constant, reflective, careful, faithful Christian thinking and Christian work that has to go into issue by issue trying to figure out how do we engage this, how do we give proper witness to Christ, how do we, as Christians, think about how this should be translated into public policy. We have to be very, very clear that the church is first and foremost a gospel people. But in this fallen world, we are also political creatures. Knowing the difference and knowing how to put the two together is a Christian challenge we'll talk about again and again. Thanks for Intelligent Christian Conversation. I'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.